For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to a very special 150th edition of the audiobook show. I'm Robert Kirkwood, and today Red Sail spends an hour in the company of the master of the spy novel, John le Carré. In a conversation that covers much of his career, John le Carré will discuss the inspiration behind many of his books, about working with Alec Guinness, about his confidence trickster father, narrating his own audiobooks, and much more. And if you're listening to this on RNIB Connect Radio, try and check out the podcast if you can, which runs for an extra 10 minutes. John le Carré started by telling Red about his book Agent Running in the Field. But first, let's hear a clip, narrated by Mr. le Carré himself.
Mr. Natzer, Alice announces with an air of high ceremony. More often, I am Lord Nat to her, but this evening I am a common knight. This very handsome and polite young man needs to talk to you most privately, but he don't want to disturb you in your moment of glory. His name is Ed. Ed, say hello to Nat. For a long moment in my memory, Ed remains standing a couple of paces behind her. This 6-foot-something, gawky, bespectacled young man, with a sense of solitude about him, and an embarrassed half-smile. I remember how 2 competing sources of light converged on him. The orange strip light from the bar, which endowed him with a celestial glow, and behind him the downlights from the swimming pool, which cast him in oversized silhouette.
Ostensibly it's a spy story, and the central figure is a slightly burned-out British overseas secret agent who lived under diplomatic cover. So he's returned to London pretty much reconciled to being on the shelf, because there isn't much use you can make of such a man. He's tarnished, as we say in the trade, he's blown, and he's not bright enough to go into the higher echelons of the Secret Service. However, a little job is found for him in an outstation, a decrepit outstation of the service, and there he tries to set up something that functions for the larger cause. He tries to integrate this little outstation into the mainstream, and that's his ambition, and by doing so, he himself will be elevated. He is passionate about badminton. I used to be passionate about badminton. And while he's playing badminton, he's accosted by a gawky, rather heavily spoken, awkward fellow, very tall in specs, who blurts at him, I'd like to play a game with you, that kind of thing. So Nat, who is my hero, says okay, and a relationship forms, a cautious one between them, and they start playing regularly, and they're very tight games. One of the things about badminton is that somebody of any age can beat somebody of any age. It's great. If you go to one of the big leisure centres, you'll see men of 65 or so giving a terrific time to people of 18 or 20. And I had this fantasy, which then informed the story, that out of their relationship would develop a political discussion, and the boy, Ed, would reveal himself as a very serious-thinking, activist-minded opponent of Brexit. Left-leaning, religious upbringing, nonconformist, and a great friend of Germany after being stationed there. We don't quite know in what capacity. And developing for Germany, for the new Germany, a considerable affection, admiration, on the grounds that this is a country that has come to terms with its errors and has been penitent and remorseful and has cleaned its past. And he believes they are the best Europeans
going. And from there, I don't think I can take you much further without spoiling your listening. Our meeting was not contrived. Not by me, not by Ed, not by any of the hidden hands supposedly pulling at his strings. I was not targeted. Ed was not put up to it. We were neither covertly nor aggressively observed. He issued a sporting challenge. I accepted it. We played. There was no contrivance, no conspiracy, no collusion. There are events in my life, only a few these days, it's true, that admit of one version only. Our meeting is such an event. My telling of it never wavered in all the times they made me repeat it.
The England that both Nat and Ed have returned to is a very different England from that they were brought up in. It's a deeply divided England because of Brexit, and it's in response to that pulling closer to the United States, which both of them feel is the wrong direction to be heading towards when President Trump is running the States.
Yes, I mean, under the slogan of take back control, the Brexiteers imagine that somehow or another we will recover our sovereignty. The reality is we shall take it back and give it straight to Trump. There is no other direction to go. And both men, independently and together, hugely resent this. And the story is about the rare thing of absolute belief. What do you do in a country that has really lost its way, lost any central conviction about itself, is basking in nostalgic memories of the wars? If we'd all somehow been at Dunkirk and been in the Battle of Britain and landed on the Normandy beachheads, we have done none of those things. The problem is that since 1945, we haven't done anything very much that is spectacular or useful to the greater world. And we've, as it's often said, we've lost an empire and not found a role. And it is in this rather directionless country, this fraught, unled, angry country, that one of these men commits an act driven by the Faustian concept that in the beginning was not the word, but the deed.
And in their reactions to what's going on in England at the time, you really draw a distinction between patriotism and the prevailing nationalism of the politics that seems to have taken control of England.
Patriotism is a decent posture which enables you to criticise your country within the democratic framework. Nationalism requires enemies, and we have made, in this Brexit process, a cheap enemy of Europe, which is a disgraceful thing after 42 years or however many of being close allies with Europe and committed to Europe, the new Europe, the reconstructed Europe, which somehow has hung together, the 47 nations have hung together in a most impressive way, and we were part of that process, and we've now tugged ourselves away from it, stepped into the middle of the Atlantic. And we really have no defined future. There's a lot of talk about the World Trade Organization replacing our relationship with the EU, but that's another fantasy that will take years to organize.
I can hear the simmering anger in your voice now, and it certainly bursts out of Ed's mouth, the younger man's mouth, in the novel. I also got the impression you really enjoyed venting a bit of spleen through him.
Yes, I mean, it is really important to draw a distinction between polemics and novel writing. It was possible for me to canalise and invest my anger in characters and divide them in different ways. I would not wish this book to be seen as a tract, but some people have taken it that way. But generally speaking, the people who have taken it that way are a bit thick.
As with, I think, all of your previous books now, you narrated the audiobook version. Does that bring out the inner actor in you?
I've been recording with the same outfit now for a number of books. with the same technician, the same producer. And I really enjoy that. That's a few days of fun. Does it bring out the latent actor in me? I think it brings out the real writer in me. I really can't write unless I'm speaking my lines, correcting my lines according to how they hear to me. I read them aloud to myself. I read them aloud to my wife, poor lady, but she puts up with it. And I love the shaping of paragraphs and the shaping of sentences tonally. And actually to hit a point in the arrangement of monosyllables and how to end a sentence with a kick, all of those things are to me vocal. It's a kind of closet oratory that you get into. And I think that applies to many writers. And storytelling was born in the spoken word. Long before people wrote things down, they spoke their stories to one another. And I think it was Ford Madox Ford who said that I write in order to speak to a friend across the fire. I share that view. So the best compliment you can pay to a story, really, is to read it aloud or have it read aloud. I really believe that. That's not simply because I'm talking on this program. It's the truth.
Do you listen to audiobooks yourself, then?
Yes, quite often, and I get sent them. It's an odd thing. There are some writers who really can't read their stuff very well, in my view, and there are others who are quite gifted and know how their stuff sounds before they read it. Then, occasionally, as with the last book, in fact, I didn't read it, and Tom Hollander, a wonderful actor, read it, and I listened to it the other day, and it's so perfect. You immediately enter into that cone where you identify with the personality of the voice, and that's how it should be. It should be bewitching.
A professional intelligence officer is no more immune to human feelings than the rest of mankind. What matters to him is the extent to which he is able to suppress them, whether in real time or, in my case, 50 years on. Until a couple of months ago, lying in bed at night in the remote farmstead in Brittany that is my home, listening to the honk of cattle and the bickering of hens, I resolutely fought off the accusing voices that from time to time attempted to disrupt my sleep. I was too young, I protested. I was too innocent, too naive, too junior. If you're looking for scalps, I told them, go to those grand masters of deception, George Smiley and his master, Control. It was their refined cunning, I insisted, their devious, scholarly intellects, not mine, that delivered the triumph and the anguish that was Windfall. It is only now, having been held to account by the service to which I devoted the best years of my life, that I am driven in age and bewilderment to set down, at whatever cost, the light and dark sides of my involvement in the affair.
Tom Hollander reading from A Legacy of Spies by John le Carré. Available wherever you buy your audiobooks and from RNIB as TB24298.
You have a very good ear for dialogue and also dialect. Certainly in this book I felt that Ed was authentically of the North, but well-travelled.
And kind of Londonised, urbanised too. But basically he spoke this kind of cadence and with a slight indignation about him and thorough and straight into your face. That was my Ed from the start. And among all the refined voices that he is surrounded by, his voice stood out.
So you could hear his voice whilst you were writing the novel?
Absolutely. And, I mean, there were other characters too. The Russian character, the old spy, he goes to visit, Nat goes to visit. And I have been many times with the Russians. And the Russians have a big heart, and frequently they have an expression in Russian. Yeah, he speaks beautifully, but he does not act so. And Arkady spoke like that. I know he did. The difficulty in such a case is to get the accent onto the page so that the reader, in his mind, hears it. even if he doesn't physically hear it.
As you have returned to your earlier work to make it into audiobooks, do you have a sinking sense that the world really hasn't changed a huge amount as far as people's suspicions of foreign countries, foreign governments are concerned, and also with Russia trying to destabilize the West?
Well, the first part of the question, has the world changed here? To my mind, far too little. I am quite radical in my perceptions about how the country should be run, what radical changes we should make. I would wish them to be made actually by a conservative government rather than a left-wing government, because then they don't look like resentful acts. I think it's high time we reduce the scale of the monarchy, put the Queen on the bicycle, as we do in foreign countries, as foreign country to Scandinavia. I would like to see the end of the public school system, simply because it is quite wrong that 8% of the public should receive these exceptional forms of education, and that becomes immediately demonstrable in our elite. The definition of a good country is twofold. It's how it looks after its losers and how it selects its elite. So far too little has changed for me. And the root cause is something I've witnessed at first hand, really, having taught at Eton and been familiar with the British establishment. The whole Brexit operation, for instance, is part of a long-standing Europhobia that nestled at the heart of the landed English countrymen. This is an English revolution, if you like, or counter-revolution that's going on, English nationalism at its worst. You know, they are the same people who gave us the Suez War and other really quite reprehensible acts. And deep down, it's a racist sentiment, and it's isolationist in the sense that the Brits, the English particularly, are the best people in the world in their opinion. Nothing to touch them. It is now, to our shame, still the case that those people, called by, if you remember, by John Major, the bastards, but they go back a lot further than that. It's to our shame that these people are really having their will with us. With the combined effect of a huge propaganda movement, I know no other word for it, that's gone on for years in social media, through the fact that our tabloid newspapers almost exclusively belong to offshore oligarchs of the far right, and because there is a way of bullying the public vocally. We have in Johnson, we have an Etonian street orator representing, if you can believe it, the man in the street with that education, that background, that elitist perception of himself. Oddly enough, Trump is up to the same game. And across Europe now, we see forms of autocracy developing and a resurgence of far-right feeling, which, curiously enough, in Eastern Europe, expresses itself in an affection for the new Russia. So ask me how I see the world now at 88. I see it quite gloomily. We need to do so many things so fast. We need to redistribute wealth. We need to level the playing field by putting everybody in the same school, which is what happens in Germany or France or Spain, the neighborhood school you go to, and you go through the system, and at least you meet the woodcutter and the carpenter and the grocer and the butcher and their sons. You can go through the English educational system now, if you're very rich, without ever meeting anybody who's gone without a meal. And that can't be right.
And then you can become Prime Minister.
And then you can become Prime Minister, exactly so. And Johnson himself, of course, was an early part of the Europhobic propaganda movement. When he was in Brussels, he invented a lot of fictions about how awful Brussels was and the bad things it was doing to us. And he actually lied to such an extent that he was thrown off one newspaper and quickly picked up by a newspaper now belonging to offshore oligarchs again.
A theme that really runs through your books is decency, something that Alec Lemus in The Spy Who Came In From the Cold calls a love of ordinary life, a respect for triviality.
It is really true. I think that has having come from such a chaotic background myself, with my dad, this recurrent confidence trickster in and out of jail. My mother left me when I was 5, and I didn't see her again till I was 21, a completely unemotional encounter by then. I sort of scrabbled around in my early years, trying to find for myself some kind of standard of life, some kind of social order that I respected. And it's very simple. I did come to the conclusion that I'm quite influenced by the Germans in this respect, funnily enough. They have their own word for it too, Anständigkeit, and it comes up all the time. It's the definition of a reasonable man or woman. And we all know, really, what the qualities are that belong to such a person. And we all know when somebody is breaking the rules of decency. So I want to believe that there is a kind of spirit level in most decent people. And the sadness is that we constantly are led by people who lack that quality.
You mentioned your father, who you've written about. I kind of wonder sometimes if you feel that he would have been a fantastic spy in the way that he was able to spin a line and gain people's confidence, but was too fond of the high life.
Much of that is true, but I think he was really compulsively dishonest. I think it was almost an illness. So he didn't make money, he made killings. And when he made a killing, he bought a Bentley, hired a chauffeur, lived very big. He did this all over the world. So I got him out of jail in Vienna, Switzerland, Jakarta. But he was recurrent. He was a recidivist. So, I mean, he set up brilliant cons, which we're still looking at and examining. And funnily enough, an American documentary maker of great distinction is exploring the possibility of making a documentary about our two lives. Because when I was in the intelligence community in West Germany during the Cold War, Ronnie, my father, pops up in East Germany trying to interpose himself as an arms dealer on their behalf. And when recently the BBC, for its own reasons, obtained my Stasi file, they also obtained my father's Stasi file, which was much fatter and more interesting than mine. And it turned out that they were sufficiently interested in him to send an agent, a spy, from Vienna, a Herr Doctor, name redacted, to inspect his luxurious office premises in German Street, West 1 or wherever it is, SW1. And the file, the Stasi file, contains a report of where the telex machine is, where the safe is, what's on each floor. And to me, with an experienced eye of my own, I see that as reconnaissance before a break-in. But whether they made the break-in, I don't know. Like all good stories, it ends too early.
Simply the fact of being your father's son was clearly a perfect training for you to join the Special Intelligence Service.
He insisted. It was his pride to send me to the best possible schools. So from the age of 5, I was in boarding school and at holiday schools, and that I did 11 years' time in boarding schools and ran away finally from Sherborne at the age of 16. I just couldn't take it anymore. But in the course of that, I was really from the very beginning, even as a small child, dissembling. I would not admit that I had no mother, so I invented a mother. They were rich private schools in those days. The young boys, many of them, had ponies. It was a country school. And so I invented a pony called Smokey. And I had spent a lot of time with my grandparents and so on. All those people spoke with regional accents, just ordinary, decent working class accents. But I quickly had to learn the language of the upper middle class, if you will. Posh. And so I had to learn the language. I had to dress and behave and learn the accents and the mannerisms and the process of thinking that was around me. It was all new, and it was all like enemy territory, and I had to adjust myself to it and be accepted as a normal citizen. And that seemed to go on, and particularly on the religious front. I finished up at Sherborne in those days, Sherborne in Dorset, and it was a ferociously hearty, really sort of outdoor games and no fooling about, and a lot of military parades. We were all cadets in the army. My particular part of it, my housemaster, really something close to a religious obsessive. Mm. And I was always groping, really, for doctrines and institutional strengths that I didn't have at home. And I think that's one reason, if I look back now on the stages in my life, I see them as moments of engagement, strong moments of engagement, whether I was teaching at Eton, or I was in MI5, or I was sick of MI5, moving to MI6, is always embrace and escape, embrace and escape. And I've never been analysed, and I hope I never will be, I mean, professionally so. But I think somehow that is a pattern that is inculcated, not least by the fact that somehow my life desertion was an important part of my upbringing. First my mother disappeared, then my father would periodically disappear, then he absolutely disappeared because he was on the run. So all that sounds rather gloomy, but for a writer, it was an amazing resource of experience and characters. And I mean, I googled my father the other day, first time I've ever done it, Ronnie Cornwall, and it just said, an acquaintance of the Cray brothers, I think he put. But we knew, you know, we knew Rahman, but they were rather lurid bad guys. I only knew they were bad guys later. But also he attracted, in this expansive, fascinating way he had with people, he was a magnet, and all sorts of famous people drifted through his house as well. Actors, and Trevor Howard came through, and a lot of forgotten names now, but they were big at that time, and he was always very proud of displaying them. And when the Australian cricket team came over, he had the whole lot down to his house in Chalfont St. Peter. So I shook hands with Don Bradman, Lindsay Hassett, Toshack, Sid Barnes, the names go on. And then when the West Indians came over, the same thing again. And for these parties, because he had these great cricketers there, people would come, anyone would love to go. So I also found myself shaking hands with Gordon Richards, who'd come to meet Don Bradman. I mean, the thing was just astronomic in its fascination. So it's something that we associate more with the Americans than ourselves, I think, this constant self-reinvention that he was capable of until he really had to take a run. And it's sort of the Gatsby life, the great Gatsby life, but you don't expect to find it in Chalfont St. Peter.
Your own life has not been without incident, as the Pigeon Tunnel bears testament to. And you've met some phenomenal people, such as Yasser Arafat and African leaders, yes, and so on and so forth. The kind of people I wouldn't have been surprised had you met them in your capacity either at Ronnie's party or in your capacity in MI6. But this is obviously all since you left. I mean, it's your life is not that dissimilar, but obviously far more honest.
I guess it's true. It has been an extraordinary life, and post-Cold War too. I don't know how to put this modestly, but I do have a big international reputation. So I'm currently selling as well in Germany or Italy or wherever it may be, as I am in England or America. And because of the mystique of espionage, which is really spun round me, I have quite easy access. So it was no problem to me. When I wanted to see Russia, of course, just before the wall came down in the perestroika years, and I wanted to get into the criminal community in Russia immediately after the wall came down. And I found that really top criminals wanted to meet me, were happy to meet me, want to talk about themselves. And it's something that Graham Greene said to me, and it's very true, don't worry when you walk into a crowded room, leave your talent behind and let them talk to you. Because actually, what people do when they meet somebody they've wanted to meet for some time or they're excited to meet, they talk about themselves. I very seldom get questioned about myself in company. It's people, Ah, you're John le Carré. Can I tell you about my daughter? Because she started writing and all that stuff. So I found in Russia or in the Middle East that people had heard of me and were very keen to meet me. And fortunately, just before I met Arafat, I'd had my face on Time magazine, on the front of Time magazine. So that was better than a visiting card as far as Arafat was concerned. And that was an extraordinary time. I had been staying. First of all, I visited Israel and met some of the special forces people, played around there. And then I went to South Lebanon and lived in, so to speak, between two refugee camps, two huge refugee camps. And I stayed with the chief of fighters, chief of Palestinian fighters in South Lebanon, in his house. And he told Arafat's camp, as it were, that I was around and I would like to meet him. And I was sitting in the Hotel Commodore, the famous haunt for journalists and spies and writers in those days, one night, and a Palestinian waiter came up to me and said, "Our chairman will see you now." So I thought, oh, Christ, that's the hotel manager. I've misbehaved. I'm going to be thrown out. What's going to happen? I walked out of the hotel, and there was two sand-coloured Volvos. They looked heavy and armoured. A bunch of boys with Kalashnikovs standing round them. "Mr. David, please." And so I got in, and they swept me through the hot dark of Beirut, as it was. And we changed, we did the hair-raising thing of going down a double carriageway across the central reservation and then on the wrong side. And we changed cars, and they kept bandaging my eyes and then taking the bandage off. And finally I found myself in a kind of Hilton for beginners, a pocked high-rise building with a lift that reluctantly worked. I was still with three or four guards, and we went up about six floors and got out. And then suddenly I was in a terribly spraunty apartment, like kind of huge dentist waiting room for rich people with rich people with bad teeth. And the wall was lined with a lot of rather beautiful Palestinian girls with ammunition across their breasts and armed to the teeth, and an empty desk at the other end of the room. There was a sudden silence. They knew the signs. I didn't. And in walked, the other end of the room, in walked Arafat, looking exactly like Arafat, with the kafir and the silver-handled pistols and all that. He stopped in front of the desk, very theatrically. The timing was wonderful. You had to wait. And then he, as it were, discovered me in the room. "Mr. David, why have you come to see me?" he said accusingly. So I thought, well, I'm a ham actor too. So I said, "Mr. Chairman, I've come to put my hand on the Palestinian heart." And at this point, he rushed at me and seized my hand and pressed it against his own heart. "It is here, it is here," he said. And everybody applauded and so on. And then, whether he took to me or whether he thought I was useful is immaterial. But I attended the last great march of the Palestinians, celebrating Black November. That was in Sidon, and I met Arafat there. And then he asked me what I was doing for New Year's Eve. So I said, "Well, so happens I'm free." And he said, "Well, then you come and sit with me at the School of the Martyrs." And I said, "That's fine, I'll do that." Martyrs being people who died for the Palestinian cause, and the school being up in the Shouf Mountains outside Beirut. So I was sort of smuggled up there, not smuggled, but a kind of dark convoy of jeeps and Land Rovers and up into the hills, no lights on, no traffic lights, all following each other very closely in a convoy, winding roads, very high up. And then this building, built in tiers down the hillside, quite a large school. And we went down to the bottom tier, which was a huge concert hall. And there were children galore, but also a lot of adults, so East Germans, people from communist countries, any number of spies, I'm sure. And Arafat's own high command, Abu Jihad, Abu Iyad, all these guys, all men, rather portly, in pressed uniforms. As I walked in, Arafat made a fuss at me and placed me to his left in the front row. And then kids climbed up onto the stage in front of us, and they began the dubka. Like that. And the clapping got louder, and we all joined in. And Arafat stretched out his arms suddenly. We were there, front row of the stalls. And I took one arm, and Abu Jihad, I think he was, on the other side, took the other arm, and between us we tossed him up onto the stage. And he seized the back of his kafir and began stamping to this dubka. And soon we were all doing it. He hauled us up onto the stage and began a conga. Everybody holding everybody's hips, long, long, and it got bigger and bigger. And then we went all round the concert to this, and it became more and more exciting, flashing lights in the ceiling. And then the whole crowd broke into the Palestinian anthem. And it was an amazing experience. And then, not long after that, the Lebanese and the Israelis had had enough of them. And so I witnessed the Palestinian departure from Lebanon, they're going down a gangway into a big liner. They were allowed to carry their guns, and some were firing into the sky. And off they went to Tunisia. So then I thought, I was just curious. I don't know that I was writing about it. I was just obsessed by what happens to this extraordinary, really forlorn, romantic crowd of men and women. And it was after Sabra and Shatila, so it was after the massacres. And it was a terrible time. So I flew to Tunis and found Arafat in what we all called the White Hotel, which was an isolated hotel on a spit of land overlooking the Med. And I got into the building. There was nobody around much. Sort of bored sentry at the doorway, and suddenly a 18, 19-year-old Palestinian kid came up to me and grabbed me and put a pistol to my temple, and, "Are you American?" Because the Americans were perceived as the people behind the massacre. It was a very inaccurate perception, I expect. Massacre at Sabra and Shatila. And I said, "No, I'm not American, I'm English. Just as bad," I said. And he marched me down the corridor. I said, "I've come to see Abu Amar, Arafat." And he marched me down the corridor, opened a door, and shoved me through. And I, to my surprise, I found myself out of doors. And there was a circular, you call it a lunging ring, where people ride round and round on horses. And Arafat, all alone, on a beautiful white Arab horse, was riding round and round. And I called out to him, "Abu Amar, it's David." And absolutely nothing happened. He didn't flinch. Went past me a couple of times. I went back to Tunis and left. And his high command, the end part of the story is, of course, known to everybody. His high command that he'd taken with him from Lebanon were installed in apartments in the city of Tunis. And the Israelis, an Israeli hit team, a couple of hit teams, I should imagine, in rubber boats, landed one night and killed them in their separate apartments, shot them in bed, wherever they were. So a very considerable assassination program took place, which really, and that's, so to speak, for me, the end of my association with the Palestinians at that time. And I do believe he was poisoned, and I do believe the intrigues around Arafat won't be known, maybe ever, who he was taking money from, who he was in reality. But one thing is kind of not known of him, because he was so horribly portrayed in the Western press, that he was, first of all, he was a very clean man physically. He was obsessed by his physical cleanness. And this, the fluff he had on his face, when you embraced him in Arab tradition, it turned out to be baby fluff, and it smelt of Johnson's baby powder. And so, really, that was the end of my Palestinian excursion, but the point of it actually was, as I told him, in that case, to get to the heart of the Palestinian cause, just as I'd tried to get to the heart of the Israeli cause, and that produced the Little Drummer Girl.
It was the Bad Godesberg incident that gave the proof, though the German authorities had no earthly means of knowing this. Before Bad Godesberg, there had been growing suspicion, a lot of it. But the high quality of the planning, as against the poor quality of the bomb, turned the suspicion into certainty. Sooner or later, they say in the trade, a man will sign his name. The vexation lies in the waiting.
Michael Jayden reading from The Little Drummer Girl by John le Carré. Available wherever you buy your audiobooks, and also available from RNIB Talking Books, read by Andrew Timothy as TB4814.
I've tried, really, since Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. I decided then, I've been sitting on my backside too long. I've got to get out into the field, as you would say. And I had ringing in my ears Graham Greene's dictum, and I'd known Greene a bit. Graham Greene's dictum that if you're going to report on human pain, you do well to share it. So my first excursion was to Phnom Penh, to Cambodia, at the end of that awful struggle, the end of the war. And I, for the first time, experienced being shot at. It's only happened to me three times. And always badly, inaccurately, but bullets whizzing around the place. Then to Saigon, as it was. And after that, then, it was the Middle Eastern engagement. Then after that again, it was Africa. It was Kenya mostly, and the exploration of misusing people for medical experiments, really, so-called clinical trials, with so-called informed consent. But it was nothing of the kind. And out of that came The Constant Gardener. And I also, in the course of writing Constant Gardener, went up to South Sudan and stayed in the northernmost food station and witnessed the horror of that, and of course the beauty of the landscape.
In The Constant Gardener, maybe you might disagree, I felt it was your angriest book and probably did more to open people's eyes to the misuse of people by big pharmaceutical companies than any investigative reporter could have done in a magazine or newspaper article. And again, actually, in The Little Drummer Girl, you know, you manage to balance both sides of the argument and make it feel as if we have reached the moral outrage at the end of the book, rather than preaching at us. And I wonder, is that a difficult balance to strike?
Well, I think almost at the beginning of this conversation, I talked about canalizing one's anger or one's emotions and dividing them up and giving them to characters, but on the principle, which I'm constantly repeating, that the cat sat on the mat is not a story, but the cat sat on the dog's mat is the beginning of a story. So look for conflict, divide up your conflict, award it, try to understand the emotions of people on different sides, and human greed, which is something I honestly feel I don't much have, but it's an enormously important factor. It drives so many people. It's quite extraordinary.
Because we are diplomats and not policemen, Tessa. The Moy government is terminally corrupt, you tell me. I never doubted it. The country is dying of AIDS. It's bankrupt. There is not a corner of it, from tourism to wildlife, to education, to transport, to welfare, to communications, that isn't falling apart from fraud, incompetence and neglect. Well observed. Ministers and officials are diverting lorry loads of food aid and medical supplies earmarked for starving refugees, sometimes with the connivance of aid agency employees, you say. Of course they are. Expenditure on the country's health runs at $5 per head per year, and that's before everybody from the top of the line to the bottom has taken his cut. The police routinely mishandle anybody unwise enough to bring these matters to public attention. Also true. You've studied their methods. They use water torture, you say. They soak people, then beat them, which reduces visible marks. You're right. They do. They're not selective. and we do not protest. They also rent out their weapons to friendly murder gangs, to be returned by first light, or you don't get your deposit back. The High Commission shares your disgust, but still we do not protest. Why not? Because we are here, mercifully, to represent our country, not theirs.
Michael Jaden reading The Constant Gardener by John le Carré. Available wherever you buy your audiobooks and also in RNIB Talking Books as TB14982.
So my last foreign excursion was quite hairy, and I was too old for it. I was in my late 70s, and that was Eastern Congo. And I stayed in Bukavu, which is on a beautiful lake, a wonderfully beautiful area, an Eden, but the scene of terrible massacres, fighting, and organized collective rape as a military weapon, because women who've been raped are just, as far as tribal ethic concern, they're no good, they're discards. And that was an extraordinary trip. And we had curfew all the time and a few episodes and riots. And with two wonderful people, both white, who were with me, I got stuck in a jeep at the edge of a flood. There was a flash flood in Bukavu. And suddenly the place became almost a lake, and we couldn't cross the lake. And so we stopped, and a bunch of boys, about sort of between 12 and 16, I would think, saw us white people in the jeep beside the lake and were terribly entertained by it and began mobbing us up and rocking the car. And fortunately, one of our number spoke all the languages and was tremendously attractive, and he got out of the car and appealed to them and made them laugh, and they wandered off. But my thought was then, if this is going to get nasty, these people in the car are going to have to look after a 78-year-old man who can't run properly and all of that. And I made that my last dare into a hairy place.
I was introduced to your work at school by my English teacher, who, even back in 1986, said that you were our modern-day equivalent of Joseph Conrad, and actually pointed to The Secret Sharer as being at the heart of the way that you wrote as well. I was wondering whether you felt an affinity with Conrad.
Look, as a cat may look at a king. Yes, I admire him hugely. I'm absolutely hypnotized by his writing skill and by his uneasy quest through life. I don't think he was a happy soul at all. But yes, Conrad was for Graham Greene, so he was for me an unreachable model. I think he's a wonderful novelist, wonderful writer. Not always right in his thinking, but it doesn't matter. He writes from huge knowledge, his experience, particularly of Southeast Asia, his experience of commanding men, of running a boat, and so on. It's always easy, it's always wonderful to remember that the whole of The Heart of Darkness, which is not a long book, actually plays going up and down the Thames. It's just one man talking to a bunch of other men about what happened to him in Congo. I love Conrad, and like other writers, they're kind of bottles on my shelf, and I take them down, sip a bit, and put them back. Honoré de Balzac is another one, a fantastic storyteller. But with the same urgency that Conrad has, Balzac was something, again, quite different but exceptional. And so I love the great storytellers.
He was the only man of us who still followed the sea. The worst that could be said of him was that he did not represent his class. He was a seaman, but he was a wanderer too, while most seamen lead, if one may so express it, a sedentary life. Their minds are of the stay-at-home order, and their home is always with them, the ship, and so is their country, the sea. One ship is very much like another, and the sea is always the same. In the immutability of their surroundings, the foreign shores, the foreign faces, the changing immensity of life glide past, veiled not by a sense of mystery, but by a slightly disdainful ignorance. For there is nothing mysterious to a seaman unless it be the sea itself, which is the mistress of his existence and as inscrutable as destiny. For the rest, after his hours of work, a casual stroll or a casual spree on shore suffices to unfold for him the secret of a whole continent, and generally he finds the secret not worth knowing. The yarns of seamen have an effective simplicity, the whole meaning of which lies within the shell of a cracked nut. But as has been said, Marlowe was not typical, if his propensity to spin yarns be accepted. And to him, the meaning of an episode was not inside, like a kernel, but outside, enveloping the tale which brought it out only as a glow brings out a haze, in the likeness of one of these misty halos that sometimes are made visible by the spectral illumination of moonshine.
Jonathan Oliver, reading Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad, which is TB15810.
If one of your books is to make it onto the English literature syllabus to be taught at A-level, which one would you most like it to be?
Well, I think the one they would have most fun with, and the one that speaks most for a period of history, is bound to be Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Spy Who Came In From the Cold was a kind of outburst, an early outburst of mine. And I think it's a meticulous thriller of its own kind. It's a book apart, a kind of outcry. You never write another one like that. Tinker Tailor, there was much more method to it, and it was more frustrating to write. And I began to love characters. That is really something terribly important about, we haven't spoken of, but it is the private affection you have for the characters you create, which makes it very difficult sometimes when they're translated into movie characters. So they lose so much for you.
You're working with your sons, I believe, on turning more of the books into screenplays for the big or small screen. Presumably you're a lot happier having more control rather than some of the rather mismanaged affairs in the past.
Very much so. I mean, what I'm doing at the moment is my life work, as if I mean, my all-day work is making an adaptation of The Spy Who Came In From the Cold and Legacy of Spies, which is the much more recent sequel to it or addition to it. Legacy of Spies works like a kind of overlay on top of the original plot. And so we're combining those two, and I'm writing that alone. I'm halfway through episode 3 now of what we think will be 6, possibly 8 episodes. And I'm enjoying that hugely. After that, now, I hope, I dream, that Susanna Beer, who directed The Night Manager, will come aboard for this. But that's all yet to be negotiated. She would like to, but we'll see whether that pans out. If not, some very good director, I hope. But there does come a point where I have to cut off and shut up, because what we want is the film of the film, not the film of the book. We don't want it personalized with my kind of style, my writing and those things. We want it to be something that filmmakers and the artists around them in their collective produce and make their own.
I will find it very difficult to hear another actor become George Smiley other than Alec Guinness. Did he become Smiley for you, or were you able to keep the two of them separate?
I think the voice did, for a start. I mean, that was the imprint of Smiley's voice, of Guinness's voice, and it affected us all. So he would call up in the evening, because he was a very lonely chap, particularly when staying alone in a hotel in London working on the thing. So we had 4 years of him back to back, two series. And he would ring up in the evening, "May I speak to Mr. David Cornwall, please?" And I'd say, "Hello, Alec. How did you know it was me?" So I told that story at some function, literary festival or whatever it was. And Alec picked up on it. And then he called and said, "May I speak to Mr. David Cornwall?" I said, "Hello, Alec." But he was magic to work with, because I suppose he entered into
the character, lived the character so intensively while it was all going on that he was obsessive, exactly as I am. I mean, if I'm working, I can't think of anything other than the work and the characters and so on. He couldn't think of it. So we did Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and I had, once that took off, I had nothing to do with it. We had a wonderful writer, Arthur Hopcraft, alas, now dead, and he did the adaptation. We had a wonderful director, and so it went, and I had no part in it at all. It was different with Smiley's People, because the writer we had collapsed on the job. I think he was unwell. Anyway, we suddenly had no script. We had Alec, we had a shooting date, we had everything except a script. What on earth do we say to each other? So Alec came here every day, and we, in about 3 weeks, we wrote 6 hours of television together. And again, it was wonderful, wonderfully instructive, because he knew exactly where the energy of the scene would lie, who owned the scene in his imagination. Was it going to be Hayden? Was it going to be, and so on. And I would sometimes write a few lines for him, and he would say, no, no, I know what to do there. And so I'd take the lines out again. And he was wonderfully collaborative. And I would propose, he never initiated, but I would be proposing the scene and how we would go, and then he would steer a bit.
We've touched on the theatrical element to writing novels and forming characters, making strong characters. I know that your sister is an actress and actually was the bassist for Charlie in The Little Drummer Girl. You're presumably a keen theatre-goer and you a keen observer of people. Do characters come to you fully formed, or do you rough them out before you start writing the novels?
I don't rough them out before, and I don't make any skeletons or charts or anything like that. I have, once I get into a novel, I have a notion of the end frame, how it will end, how the reader should feel when he closes the book, or, as you might say, when he walks out of the cinema, the end frame, what's happening here. When it comes to character, the whole excitement of discovering a character comes in the writing. As the scenes began to form themselves, so the character takes a role and acquires attributes and failings and longings that become apparent in him. So if we look at this present book, Nat starts as a rather, quite a rough egg, really, and an unthinking man in many respects, although he's been a good intelligence officer. And what really happens is that both in his marriage and in his relationship with this young man, he grows a heart. And that was an excitement for me. That's not something I could have written down to begin with. It was the natural evolution of the story as it came about. When we talk theatre, I think it's impossible to describe, and I'm so, in some ways, still so obsessed by it. My father was enormously theatrical in spirit and could animate a room in his own strange way. And Charlotte inherited a theatrical skill. I inherited mimicry from somewhere, but I have no music. So the compensation really is the spoken word, the human voice. I don't go to theatre a lot, largely because I'm deaf. And it irritates me very much when I can't hear the words, because I go for the words. I have a close relationship with Tom Stoppard and have had it for a long time. And I like reading Tom's plays. And he's just written a new one, which is opening soon. And I've no doubt he'll send me the text, and I shall go and watch the play. And otherwise, if we're still talking about the making of character, what I know I have to do is, however bad they are, so to speak, or however twisted, I have to feel that there's a bit of me that is that character. Even now that I've grown up, since I've grown up, the women too. But I began with such an ignorance of women in my life. Just, if you think of just male boarding schools, I don't think I had a proper hug till I was about 11. And that was just a sort of mumsy lady who decided to give me a hug. And so in the early books, the women are really, they're either virginal or they're harridans. virgin pure, as it were. I mean, not necessarily physically, but in their perception of life, like Liz Gold and Spy coming from the cold, an absolutely clean-minded woman. And then I think maybe the little drummer girl was my... Because I knew my sister, maybe that helped. And she was only my half-sister. We didn't grow up together much, so...
The majority of the women in your books, though, are actually decent people. I mean, we'll come back to that theme of decency. They don't sell out their men for money or love. They might do because they've been betrayed, but that's in some ways more understandable. Do you think the truly terrible things in life are usually perpetrated by men?
I do. I mean, women can go crazy too, and women can be evil, just as men can, individually. But in my experience, at least, and I don't know how much it's changed, but not that much, men together conspiring in your smoke-filled room can go completely nuts. Mm-hmm. They can put together something that is just irrational, and there's nobody there to say, stop, just think what you're doing. So the Bay of Pigs is a perfect example, if you remember. That was the Special Forces American invasion of Cuba. And the fantasy was, exactly as with the Iraq War, that the people invaded would be terribly grateful, and they'd rush down to the beach and embrace the army. Rumsfeld thought that when the tanks went into Baghdad, the population put roses on them. So idiotic that I think that if Mrs. Rumsfeld had said, idiot, and just pull back a bit, he might have spared himself that fantasy. But yes, repeatedly, it's a boys' game. And of course, this government is a boys' game, cooked up by boys, driven by boys. The women are at the moment shadow figures, not allowed to speak in the cabinet. So the short answer is, men together can go nuts. Add women and sanity breaks out.
Has there ever been a decent blind spy?
A decent blind spy. I'm trying to think. I'm certain that in the research departments during the Cold War in MI5 and MI6, there was a man who hovered between these two organizations with an amazingly retentive memory. And I know that somebody read files to him. And in those days, of course, everything was files and card indices. And he had that kind of retentive genius. MI5 in those days also had disabled people, if we're allowed to use that word, on wheelchairs and things. It was very moving. You'll never get better company, funnier company, really, more assorted company than in those spook organizations. They are fun.
Coming from a broken home, Roach was also a natural watcher. In Roach's observation, Jim did not stop at the school buildings, but continued across the sweep to the stable yard. He knew the layout of the place already. Roach decided later that he must have made a reconnaissance or studied maps. Even when he reached the yard, he didn't stop, but drove straight onto the wet grass, travelling at speed to keep the momentum. Then over the hummock into the dip, head first and out of sight. Roach half expected the caravan to jackknife on the brink. Jim took it over so fast. But instead, it just lifted its tail and disappeared like a giant rabbit into its hole. The dip is a piece of Thursgood folklore. It lies in a patch of waste land between the orchard, the fruit house, and the stable yard. To look at, it is no more than a depression in the ground, grass-covered, with hummocks on the northern side, each about boy height, and covered in tufted thickets, which in summer grow spongy. It is these hummocks that give the dip its special virtue as a playground, and also its reputation, which varies with fantasy of each new generation of boys. They are the traces of an open-cast silver mine, says one year, and digs enthusiastically for wealth. They are a Romano-British fort, says another, and stages battles with sticks and clay missiles. To the others, the dip is a bomb crater from the war, and the hummocks are seated bodies buried in the blast. The truth is more prosaic. 6 years ago, and not long before his abrupt elopement with a receptionist from the Castle Hotel, Thursgood's father had launched an appeal for a swimming pool and persuaded the boys to dig a large hole with a deep and a shallow end, But the money that came in was never quite enough to finance the ambition, so it was frittered away on other schemes, such as a new projector for the art school, and a plan to grow mushrooms in the school cellars. And even, said the cruel ones, to feather a nest for certain illicit lovers when they eventually took flight to Germany, the lady's native home.
Michael Jaden reading from Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy by John le Carré. Available wherever you buy your audiobooks. It's also available from RNIB Library, read by Andrew Timothy as TB2499. Alas, that's all the time we have in today's show. A huge thank you to John le Carré. As I said, if you're listening to this on RNIB Connect Radio, try and find the podcast if you can. Just search for RNIB Audiobook in your favourite podcast app. It runs for around an extra 10 minutes. If you are listening to the podcast version, please like and subscribe, rate it and leave a review if you can. And John le Carré will be back in a future edition of the Audiobook Show with the books of his life. If you want any more information, you can find us on Twitter. I'm at @talking_books and Red is at @redsail. REDSZELL.
John le Carré, David Cornwell, thank you so much for giving up so much of your afternoon to speak to the listeners and to take us into the world of your 25 wonderful novels.
Thanks very much. I've thoroughly enjoyed our talk.